He looks determined without being ruthless. Something heroic in his manner. There's a courage about him. Doesn't look like a killer. Comes across so calm. Acts like he has a dream. Full of passion.
You don't trust me, huh?
Well, you know why.
I do. We're not supposed to trust anyone in our profession anyway.
Peace, 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 and welcome to The Rematch, which is part of the BasketballNews.com podcast network. On The Rematch, you'll hear in-depth interviews with notable names from all walks of life. Because sometimes the media just doesn't get it right. The Rematch is that second opportunity to clarify, put things in proper context, correct fake news or misreported controversy. The media still exists as the most powerful entity on earth because they control the minds of the masses. I'm Matan Thomas, and the full truth is what we are aiming to catch. Many media stories omit details that would dilute their clickbait roar, and that's why there's a need for the rematch. I sat down with NBA legend Spencer Haywood. We discussed his thoughts on the HBO hit show Winning Time, the rise of the Lakers dynasty, if he had any issues with the show or how he was depicted as some of his teammates have publicly expressed. We discussed him taking the NBA to the Supreme Court and winning, substance abuse, redemption, his relationship with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and so much more. Every young ball player should know about Spencer Haywood. If it weren't for him, nobody would be able to leave school early for the pro. He changed everything.
Mr. Spencer Haywood, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
Oh, thank you for coming on the show. I'm doing great. BasketballNews.com and Fly TV. You know, there's a lot that I want to talk to you about. The new show, Winning Time, it has really brought you back into the center of attention. And I'm sure your phone has been ringing off the hook with reporters who want to talk to you about all the things that it talked about on Winning Time. So I definitely want to get to all of that, but I want to go back first because I want all of my audience to be able to know how you got to that point, because a lot happened before that point of the 79-80 championship Lakers. So I want to go all the way back, if that's all right. Is that cool with you?
Yeah, that'd be great because, you know, that was just 1 year of my life.
Right.
Everybody's like, oh my God, what a year.
But yeah.
No, that was my worst year and my 1 year of my life. So let me start off by stating where I'm from.
I'm
from Silver City, Mississippi. There ain't no silver and it ain't no city. Population at the time when I was growing up was 275, and we have increased our status now. I was looking on Google and YouTube the other day, and we are up to 300.
300 people?
300 people, yeah. And so it was surrounded by cotton fields, farmers, and my lifestyle at that time was indentured slavery, because slavery was abolished, but yet not in Silver City. Silver City, you had to live in the man's house, and then you would go out and do all of the field work, everything, and you would continue that cycle forever and ever and ever. And so I was a cotton picker, picking cotton from sun up to sun down. My whole family was cotton pickers. We were making $2 a day. And $2 a day, you couldn't survive, because every year we had to borrow money for Christmas, to celebrate Christmas and celebrate. My mother was a devout Christian, so it was a Christian holiday. And we never could pay it back, because we didn't take care of the books. They took care of the books, and so they kept it that you always owed them something. And so we were always trying to pay that debt off. And so picking cotton and chopping cotton, first you plant the cotton. And during that time, they would shut down the schools because we were the farmers. The white kids could go to their school. It was a segregated school, of course. So you could go to school if you were white, but if you were black, you had to shut down the school and do the planting. And then when the cotton grew, you would then have to shut it down again. If it came in at that particular time, you shut the school down again. So it wasn't about education or anything. And we always got the books, the used books from the white schools that was marked up and everything. And the only history that I got a chance to know was about white history and about what was going on and how great the secessionists were in terms of all of the, you know, the North and the South, but the South was the winner. And this is what's going on today, basically saying the South won right. the Civil War and all that stuff. So,
Let me ask you this. What year was this? Because you're talking as far as indentured slavery, and I'm doing my calculations, but what year is this that you're talking about?
We're talking 1965, 64.
And this was the climate in Mississippi Civil in 1964? City, Mississippi.
And throughout Mississippi and through some parts of Alabama, some parts of Louisiana. Oh, yeah.
Wow. And this was your whole childhood. This was like from
this is my complete childhood, yes.
Until you were like
14. When I was born, I was born on my mother's bed where I was conceived, and the midwife and everybody pulled me out. And so when the farmers and the men who were like there to look after my mother to make sure that the birth came out pretty good, they looked at my hand and they saw these big hands and with lines all in it. And the first thing popped into their head was like, this baby is going to be the best cotton picker this county had ever witnessed.
Wow.
So I grew up with the idea that I was going to be the best cotton picker this county had ever produced. So I would go out and pick cotton as if I was training basketball, just picking cotton. And I ended up being a real good cotton picker because I liked it and I was enjoying it because I was competing. I wanted to keep my brothers in place. I wanted to keep all of the people that was in the field where we was working because I was looked upon as like this cotton picker. He's going to be the best. So I was picking from two rows instead of one row of cotton. Two rows is if you line them up and it's like one on one side, one on the other. So I'm picking from both sides with both hands. And I'm dragging a sack, yards and yards down the row of cotton. Then you fill it up. It's got 100 pounds in it. You put it on your back and you walk back to the trailer. You weigh it and then you dump it. And then you go back to where you had left off from.
Okay.
And in the process, what the Lord was doing was developing something else for me.
Got you.
So all of a sudden, my left hand was just as useful as my right hand because I'm picking cotton, and I have to pick it cotton out of a thorn. A thorn is like it's like a big thorn. If you don't pick it gently, you tear your hand up. And also, I was dragging this sack, so my legs got very strong. And so when I started to play basketball, everything came pretty easy. You know, it's easy greasy. And so the farmers start looking at, well, wait a minute, this guy might leave our farm. So we got to put him in jail. And if need be, we'll put him in prison in departurement where they would do it all young males then. They didn't hang you or kill you. You were used as farm animals. So they would put you in jail or in prison. And you come out and you can't go back to school. So you stay on that farm and you work that farm for the rest of your life. Many of my people before me, that's how they survived. And that's what happened to them. So they put me in jail. And when I got out of jail at 14, my mother said, you got to get out of here. We got to get you up north. Right. Sounded like some slavery.
It really does. North. Well, wait, but so they put you in jail in order to limit your possibilities, because then once you're in jail, then you can't go to school, then you can't go. So is that, so to keep you kind of indentured, that was their system?
That's
wow.
The system. Yes,
That is wicked.
So
that's wicked.
It's wicked. So yeah. Then I ended up, we raised enough money. Different neighbors came through and said, look, I don't want them to see me helping you out, Eunice, because I don't want them to get my family. So they ended up, we getting enough money. It was like $17 to get on the bus to Chicago. My brothers had left Mississippi years before. Okay. And they were in Chicago, so I thought I'll get to Chicago. I got to the promised land. I'm off, out of slavery. So wow. I get up there, and I'm hooking up with my brother. But before I hooked up with my brother, I met this guy in the bus station, and he's selling the Muhammad Speak, the black newspaper from the Nation of Islam. And I was like fascinated by that paper because I had never seen black people in a newspaper. Never in my life, never, ever, ever. Even if they murdered somebody, they wasn't in the newspaper downside because they didn't want to show black people exist. So I was just talking to him, and he was talking about, come on by the mosque and do this. And I was, what is a mosque, man? What are you talking about? And my brother came up rolling up on us, and he was like, man, don't you talk to them. You get away from them. Them boys are militants, and they are this and this and that. And I was, oh, that sounds really good, what he was talking about. So we go over to my home where I'm supposed to stay. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at this brownstone, and I'm like, wait a minute. Finally, I'm going to have my own bedroom. I'm going to have my own stuff. And because I had been living with my brothers, and we are three of us in a bed all of that time.
Okay.
And I'm saying one of us was a bedwetter, and it wasn't me.
Gotcha. All right.
So I'll tell you who it was. It was me.
You ain't got to tell the business.
So it was Floyd.
It was Floyd. There you go. Call him out, man.
Call him out. So Floyd. So I always smell like piss.
Oh, wow.
So here I am thinking, man, I'm looking in Chicago, like cars zooming by, things are so fast. I was like, whoa, shit. I was riding in a mule back in Mississippi. All of a sudden, these cars and stuff zooming and stuff. And I'm thinking, I'm going upstairs and get my room, claim it. I got my own room. And they was like, no, these are other people living down here. We live on the top up here. This is your corner.
Yeah, just a whole new concept.
I got to live with Andrew.
Wow.
So that was my experience into the big city.
Right.
And then I found out my brothers, they would come down to Mississippi every year in these brand new cars with a roll of money and new suits on. And I was like, well, where's the car? Man, that was a rental car. I was like, oh, man, well, this life is being disappointing here coming up north. The car was rental. I didn't have my big room that I wanted.
Right.
And so we were living and working. And so I got a false ID so I could go get a job because everybody had to work in that house. So I was, turning 15. I had to paint in my mustache a little bit, and I got a Social Security card. Went down to Fred Harvard's restaurant downtown, got a job as a busboy, and that was beautiful. But my jacket was way up on my arm because my arms were long. And lo and behold, 4th of July or some holiday or something was coming up. And my brother, who was raised in the North, Roy, he was raised by my aunt in Detroit because we had like the five boys, somebody going to go up north to help the aunt out. And he was that brother. So he walk in and he's got on his cardigan shirt, wingtip shoes, pants creased nicely. Mm-hmm. And I'm, we're getting ready to go out. And I'm looking at my brothers. They got on these. Andrew and Joe, they have on these jelly-looking suits, these shiny things, those cheap Chicago-looking suits with fake Stacy Adams shoes on and a half a pint of whiskey in the back pocket.
Okay.
And a little derby hat, green hat, the lime green. And I was like sizing them up like, boy, I sure would like to be with that brother over there, not with these guys.
Oh, I guess.
We went out, my brother and I, because he was a student and playing at Bowling Green State University. Uh-huh. He said, come on, let's go play some basketball. Your boys, and because my brothers was talking, Yeah, we got another player, man. He's going to be better than you. I tell you what, y'all need to go play and see what's going on. So we all went over to the playground to play. And I'm playing against my brother, and I'm playing all right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my brothers are drinking, and they drinking that alcohol. So they was drinking their whiskey out of their back pocket. And so they got bored with the game, and so they left. And my brother Roy and I was just saying, man, let's play some more. And he kept playing, showing me different things. And we played for like about 4 hours that day, man, just balling.
Huh.
And he said to me, you got to come with me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm coming with you. You're getting me out of this hellhole I'm in now.
Right.
And so he packed up, he said, pack up your bags. And I came downstairs to get in the car. I had a 10-pound brown paper bag with all my gear in it.
Okay.
I only had one pair of pants, one shirt, no shoes, and I had my Converse on. I'm like, I'm ready to roll, man. We roll into Bowling Green State University. I was like, a big old university? Oh, man, this is so great. Look at all these buildings. And then you had Howard Komeis, Nate Thurman, all those guys playing mm-hmm. because they was getting ready for the summer, you know, playing mm-hmm. and getting checked out. They was with, I don't know what, Nate was with Golden State, I think, and Howard Komeis was with the Pistons. And then you had all the college guys, you know, playing on Bowling Green. So I was out there playing with those guys. I was like, hog heaven. And plus, I had a chance to integrate my life because I couldn't stay in the dorm because the dorm matron was saying, nope, we can't have no stragglers staying in my dorm. Now, I'll tell you what, he could stay off campus, but he ain't staying in my dorm. So I stayed with the white boys on the team because he never looked for me with them guys. So I just was hanging, man. I was getting integrated to life and everything. And this big tournament was coming up in Detroit. And mm-hmm. that was the goal, to get back to Detroit and get the eye of the great coach, Will Robinson. So my brother enrolled me into this Summer League tournament. So I got out there and played at mm-hmm. you know, the Crunk boxing arena, mm-hmm. but they had outdoor courts in Detroit as well. So I went out there and I played against George Trapp, all of the great high school players in Detroit. And being that I had been working from sun up to sundown and it was outdoor,
it was hot to me.
And my telltale sign was when we walked into the locker room to get dressed, all the players were arguing about, I'm not going to wear these Converse. I want to wear some Adidas. If I don't have my Adidas, I'm not going out there and play. And I was like, whoa. And I looked at my shoe in the bottom of my, there was a hole in it.
Right.
I had cardboard paper in my shoe.
Right.
So I was like, wow, I'm going to get new shoes too. So I put on them shoes, man. I feel like, wow, this is my new life. And I picked up the shoes that they were throwing away. And uh-huh. put them aside because I'm going to send them back home to my brothers and all the people down there who don't have good shoes.
Right. And, so you had a whole different type of mentality than everybody else had because of where you came from as an indentured. I mean, I said indentured servant, but you said indentured slavery. So that's what it actually was. So you mm-hmm. so you continued, you became the number one player in Detroit, number one high school player in Detroit.
Yeah,
which was amazing to come, and then you never had played basketball before, to being the number one player in Detroit. And I want to fast forward a little bit because you then, and I want to ask you how it got to this point when you were selected for the USA team, and you were only 19 years old at that time.
18 actually when I got selected.
So you was 18 when you got selected. tell me about that experience and how you went to tryouts. Did you think you was going to make it? Like, you're playing against the best, and they're just figuring out all these great, amazing players that you can name off that are getting cut, but you're not getting cut. Like, walk me through that process.
Well, what happened was I was at Trinidad State Junior College. Before I went to Trinidad State Junior College,
mm-hmm.
I signed with the University of Tennessee, not realizing that I was the first or second black player to play in the Southeastern Conference.
Okay.
Adolph Rupp from the University of Kentucky had lost to five blacks in 66 in the championship in the NCAA finals against Texas Western. So in his mind, he wanted the next big black superstar. But Tennessee grabbed me before he could recruit me. And so it was this war going on between the two schools and what I should do. And then Will Robinson came in and said, look, why don't you just go to a junior college for a year, maintain a B average, and then you can go to whatever university you want to. You can't play as a freshman anyway, so this would be a good idea. So I said, okay. So I ended up at Trinidad State Junior College and became the outstanding and the MVP for the junior college players. Then we had a, they were like trying to assemble a team and a group of players to come to Albuquerque, New Mexico to try out for the Olympics.
Okay. So
Jerry Tarkanian, who was UNLV coach later, but he was a junior college coach before, he said, let me put together a team of renegades from the junior college rankings, and we'll bring them down as a team. And so we, they brought us down as a team, and everybody was wondering, why is he here? Because all the other junior college players was in their sophomore year, and I was a freshman.
Like,
what is he doing? Why are you here? And Jerry was like, that's my best player. That's our best player. We're just going to bring him along, let y'all see him. Even if you don't make the team, I want you to see him. And I'm thinking, you know, while I'm there, I'm picking up all of the gear. I'm, you know, guys who are like, I don't want this shirt. I'm like, oh, put that in my bag.
I got you.
I'm going to go back. Yeah, I'm going back to Detroit, man.
Yeah. Like,
I tried out for the Olympic team. They might have told me I was too young or whatever, but I didn't make it, but I tried out.
Right.
So we are playing, and we're going through all kinds of rigorous training and everything. And I'm just, you know, I'm out of the cotton field 3 years, you know.
Right.
So this is like, shoot, we're practicing 2.5 hours today. I was like, that's all?
Yeah, right. Right.
So I was like running and jumping over the basket and everything. And so Hank Iver kept asking Jerry, who is this boy? What is he, a freshman? And then they started lobbying, could we take a freshman on this team? And then I started thinking, oh, wait a minute. They looking at me for real.
Right.
And so we get to the pool where everybody's sitting in the arena and sitting on the floor, and we're picking the team.
Okay.
And they would start cutting Pete Maravich.
Pistol Pete?
Pistol Pete got cut.
Okay.
Calvin Murphy got cut. Yeah. Rick Mount got cut. Now, these guys, Pete was averaging 44 a game. Rick Mount was averaging 39 a game at Purdue.
Right.
And Calvin Murphy was averaging 33 a game at Niagara. Yeah. And so there's other players that was like, wasn't even invited. Bob, the late Bob Lanier, all these players, man. There's so many players that wasn't invited. And all of a sudden, he says, well, all right, this is our team right here, as we know it. We're picking the young boy. We're picking Spencer Haywood from Trinidad. I was like, oh! I'm on the team. So then he says, well, okay, now listen, we got to get together. We got to get everybody, should have brought their pass, their passports or not passports, but your birth certificates with you. And I'm like, oh boy, this is going to be drama here. Because I don't have.
We have a birth certificate.
I didn't have a birth certificate. So, so we call my mom. She says, I got a birth certificate right here. And it's in my Bible written under John 21.
Okay.
That's his birth certificate.
Okay.
So they had to send a camera person down there to take a picture of it, take it back up to Jackson, Mississippi to get a birth certificate. And I created a birth certificate. There I was with my birth certificate. Yeah, y'all.
Wow.
So we're off to Russia and Yugoslavia and then to Finland. And then we roam back into New York and scrimmage the Knicks, and we scrimmaged Cincinnati. And when we got to the Knicks, and Willis Reed was telling me, man, you know, you guys are going to win. Y'all going to be all right, because we were picked to finish last that year because no Kareem, No right. Alvin Hayes, no Wes Unseld. Right. So it was like, hey, these guys are going to finish last. And then we got to Cincinnati, played with Cincinnati. And Oscar Robertson said to us, man, look, y'all going to win this thing, man. I was just there 4 years ago. He was there in 60 or 64, but he was there in the Olympics. And me and Jerry West, we set the table. Y'all going to be all right. And so we went down to Mexico City where the games were being.
So, pause there, because that was, and I got to set the scene, because that was a very iconic year. That was the year of the 68 Olympics when you had John Carlos and Tommy Smith. And, you know, you mentioned that Kareem wasn't going that year, but because he was going to boycott the 68 Olympics. Talk to me about the climate that you were going into and everything that was going on with the players, you know, socially. You had Dr. Harry Edwards meeting with everybody and saying what everybody was going to do. Talk to me about how it was there while that was all being put together.
Well, when we arrived as the USA basketball team, we arrived at the compound. We call it the compound at that mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. But it was the Olympic Village. And so here's this big old boy, man, looking at our bus when we coming in. And it's like, who is this big old Negro? Mm-hmm. And it was George Foreman. Man, yeah, man, I'm going to knock out everybody in the scene, Russia, anybody come my way, I'm putting them down. And we're like, okay, brother, okay. Cool. And then here come these two dudes coming across the yard, coming to meet us on the bus. And they were like, hey, Charlie, because John knew Charlie from Harlem when they grew up in New York.
Okay.
And so Charlie was all squished up like, oh, man, Dean told me not to talk to them.
Oh, really? Dean Smith, told him not to talk to John Carlos?
No, he's like squeaky, like all nervous and stuff. And JoJo White said, man, these are our guys, man. So because we were all going to be living together anyway, because the men live in the same area and the women live in another area.
Okay.
So, and we were like, man, them guys look cool. They were like mature. And for me, I'm like, whoa, this
right,
is
right, right.
I am like the man in the mix of all of this stuff here. And Bob Beamon comes floating around the corner. Hey, man, I'm jumping over the pit. He set a record in the long jump.
Wow.
But John and Tommy was like, cool, man. They were like, you know, I was like, oh, so those are the leaders for the Olympics.
Right.
For this old Olympics here. So I'm going to brush up against them as much as I can.
Yeah, of course.
And God was like, no, you don't. Don't. Now, wait a minute. Y'all got to stay away from them boys.
Yeah.
Like, what the heck is y'all? Everybody's so panicked about these guys. And so we get into the big meeting, you know, that pull us all together and said, hey, you know, we got some guests coming in to talk to you about the importance of the Olympics, the importance of these games. And we know that there's a lot of stress and turmoil that's going on out into the world. And Kareem didn't come because he wanted to stand up for Black people in America, that we wasn't getting equal justice under the law. A number of other players didn't show up for tryouts. So we got to deal with what we got to deal with. And then we have the track team. These guys might have some statements to say and talk. So we're bringing in, the first speaker is Wilma Rudolph. She comes in and she's talking. You know, she's a world champion and gold medalist. And then they brought in Jesse Owens.
Okay.
And he's talking to us about, you know, if you guys play your cards right, do good out here with the Olympics, you can get back home and boy, they're going to treat you real good back in America. Huh. When you get back home and you can get jobs and stuff. And John Carlos, Sir, we can't get no jobs when we get back there. These people hate us.
That's John Carlos said.
And so right away, we were like, oh, boy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. And so Jesse kind of got a little teed off. He said, hey, what would you would have done if you had to run in the front of Hitler?
Like, Oh, daddy-o. Oh.
Oh, daddy-o. We all right now. John was all right. Everybody was all good.
Like,
he dropped the H-man on us. So
yeah.
It's all cool. So we started participating and we were just winning all of our stuff. And then we got to the final race with John and Tommy, and Bob Beamon had jumped and set his record. And then we went over to the field and see, you know, it's track and field. So you're supporting your team.
Right.
So them boys lined up, gun, pop, pow. He was running and stuff, man. I was like, woo-wee. I said, Tommy is beating John, man. And John, on the turn, he started looking over at the little Australian dude. I was like, oh, John, keep your eye on the track. Come on, man. And he finished the rope, and there it was. I was like, oh, John didn't finish second. He finished third. I was like, oh, man. Because that's my hero. That's my guy.
You know? I got you.
I'm learning, and Tommy is, like, quiet like me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but that was John Carlos. So, like, New York, abrasive.
Right. From Harlem.
Out of gravity. Yeah. So, and then we're like waiting. They go up on the thing and they putting on the gloves and shit. And I'm like, whoa, beautiful. Right on, brother.
Right.
And man, when they came off that podium, Avery Brundage, I want you out of here. I want you out of this Olympic Village. You're unfit. And the press was like, y'all are traitors. Yeah.
Wow. And
they escorted them out of the Olympic. And they came and had another meeting with us. Look, I'll tell you what. If you think about doing anything before your final game or anything during your game, we're going to take your passport. You're stuck in Mexico. Right?
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, I want to get back to Detroit, bro.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was that afterwards then, after that happened, when George Foreman won and he took out the flag and he was like, was that after they told all you all that? But that wasn't before John Carlos. That was after them.
I'm trying to think if it was either. I'm not sure. Right.
Okay. This time. Interesting.
But I know George Foreman always said that he was going to, because he had no place to stay either. He was living in a boy's home in Houston.
Oh, got you.
So it was like, hey, man, I got to get some light on me. America is great and everything is great for me. Wow. I just want to be able to box and get my family out of poverty and live large. So if it means putting that flag up, because we all had the flag because we are Americans.
Right. But I just thought it was interesting.
The Olympic team.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting that he chose to put the flag up at the same, you know, meet that John Carlos. You know what I mean? Almost like, you know, I'm not with them. You know what I mean? I'm here with y'all.
Well, he wasn't the only one.
I hear you.
Yeah, it wasn't like that, you know. We were like, you know, hey, man.
Right. So when
you know, like, bro, we don't want no troubles out of here.
Nah, dang. So
we talking about I boycotted the Olympics, and you talk, man, we don't want no troubles.
Right. So when y'all played, you set the scoring.
Record.
The scoring record that was still set for like years until KD.
44 years.
It kept going for 44. Right. And you set the rebounding record. And you was 19 years old.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Also the field goal percentage record that still stands.
Wow. At 19.
So what happened was, now here's another American story. When I get up on the podium, we won the Olympic gold and everything, and they passing out the medals for your neck and everything. So I'm standing between Bill Hoskett and JoJo White.
Okay.
So, and they're looking over at me when Bill Hoskett received his and JoJo was getting ready to receive his. So, and I'm standing there and I'm like, I'm just booing. I'm crying like this. I'm just like, it happened. Because I didn't think about it until I was standing right there putting that medal on. And Bill Hoskett hit me. Hey, stand up, stand strong. And JoJo, don't you be falling out in here. It's medal time. And then Mike Silliman, that's what we get for bringing them young boys in.
Oh, really?
Oh. He's on our team, but he's always rubbing it in.
Right.
Can't even stand up, get his medal, man. So they put the medal on, I'm still going.
So what was going through your mind while you was overcome with emotions?
I was thinking, 4 years before, I'm in this cotton field.
I figured.
I couldn't get out of the cotton field.
Right.
My family was indentured slavery. And now everybody's screaming, Spencer Haywood, America, America, America. And wow. then, you know, we had the flag flying right over us.
Right.
Because of America. I was like, wow, I was a slave. And now I'm an American hero.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. I can't even imagine the amount of emotions that you felt just reflecting
emotions,
on
man,
everything.
Emotions.
And so from there, I thought it was
so now
really,
I go from the emotions of that
yeah.
to all of a sudden, I'm suing the NBA.
Right, and that's what I was going to get to.
To get my mother out of the cotton field and my family out of the cotton field. So and everybody is saying, what a troublemaker. Ooh,
right.
What an ungrateful troublemaker. He's a piece of garbage.
Right. So isn't it interesting that they had no problem with you going to the Olympics to win the gold, but then when you came back and wanted to have employment, then they said, no, you can't do that. I'm like, wait a minute. So he could go in there and go to the Olympics and win the gold for you, but he can't come back in and have – and that goes back to what – that goes back to what John Carlos said when y'all was at that meeting. You remember when? Okay, so you with me? So let's go with that. Let's go to now the Supreme Court. Well, I told you I wanted to slow walk this before we get to winning time because you had a whole lot of stuff that happened before that year.
Yes,
I'll fast forward a little bit. You played a year in the ABA, then you won MVP. You had like 30 and 20, something like that. Crazy.
Yeah.
As a rookie, yeah, I saw that, and so. The talk about how the league did not want you to play there because you were 4 years removed from high school, and then you had to take them to the Supreme Court, and you won in this historic victory that would allow athletes forever to be able to leave college early. So none of them would have been able to do that if it weren't for you.
All of those things.
Right.
Or the European leagues, whatever. But so when
Black man, you took the league to the Supreme Court. It was a racist ass rule and you made a difference.
Look, I'm not saying that I regret it, but there's been time I did. I mean, shit, you talking about four teams in 10 years? You talking about every owner in the league treat me like a pariah.
Once you ring the white man's bell, they don't forget.
And it drove me to it. Dark place.
So when I signed with Seattle for the rights to play,
mm-hmm.
oh my God, everything, I was this American hero. All of a sudden, I am like, you're like Muhammad Ali. You're like Kurt Flood. You are those kind of people, huh? I just want to make money, get my mother out of the cotton field. Come on.
Wow.
Let me play. And no, I want you to sit out. I'm like, I'm not sitting out. I want to play. And
right.
Sam Schulman, the owner of the Sonics, said, let's play. And mm-hmm. so my first game, I walk out on the floor and I'm playing. And then 10 games in, I walk out on the floor and they said, ladies and gentlemen, we have an illegal player on the floor, number 24.
Mm.
I'm looking around. Yeah, I guess that's my number.
So what did they do? They took you off the floor?
Of course they did. They escorted me off the floor and said, get out of there and go sit on the bus or wherever, but you can't be in the arena.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I stood out of that. And then I get an injunction to play. And then they like threw things on me and hit me with bottles and stuff. Back then they didn't have plastic bottles, they had real bottles.
Oh, wow.
Like what I experienced in Mississippi as a kid growing up. So I was well versed in the behavior that was going to take place.
You're talking about the racism. You're talking about the racism and the hatred.
Oh,
so that's
God.
What they just. Let's pause there for a second to really describe that atmosphere of what you went through. So you're playing. All you're guilty of doing is trying to play basketball and earn a living. You didn't do anything else. And so for that, they were upset with you because that wasn't the norm of the rules. And so you became the. What? Like everything that this is
I was a pariah. I was the ungrateful American that we allowed you to play in the Olympics and not that I was saving the Olympics, but we allowed
right.
you to do all of these things and you're so ungrateful and you're screwing up the college because the NCAA had filed suit with the NBA, wrapped under the NBA. The ABA had filed suit for me leaving the ABA.
And oh, so wow.
Like three suits going on against me. And,
wow. And, then and you're how old at this time? How old are you?
20.
20 years old. You're all yeah. dealing with all of this at 20 years
all
old.
All of this adversity. And then you had the NBA had told the old players in the union, you cannot back him in this fight. And the other thing that's going to happen, if this guy win this case, you older players, you veterans are going to be kicked out, and all of the young guys are going to come in, and you're out of a job. So they beat me up too. No. The veterans.
That was a scare tactic.
Hit me up on picks and stuff. And in fact, when I got to Chicago one night, I was playing against the Chicago Bulls. I was just down there warming up. And Chet Walker said he hurt his ankle while I was warming up, and they sued me the next day for $600,000.
Wait, based on what?
That I was on the floor.
Oh, because they said you weren't supposed to be on there. And what? Like what? You he tripped over your foot, and then he's going to sue you?
No, he didn't trip over his foot.
No, that was what he was saying.
Yeah. So he was in the warm-up. He was following the owners who were like dead set against me, but yet they were all trying to figure out how to get me. So you had the owner of the Lakers, Jack Ken Cook, was like, he can't play here. But talking to my agent, like, how can we get him with Wilt and Jerry and Elgin? We can win championships with this guy. Now we got to figure this out. But in the meantime, in public, he is unfit to come into the league.
You know? Oh, wow. Interesting.
Garbage.
Interesting.
And so that was the whole process going on and on and on. So I get to Cincinnati, and they hand me an injunction. And the announcer would always come on, ladies and gentlemen, we have an injunction tonight against number 24, the illegal player on the floor. And this injunction read, he must be sitting outside on which this arena sat on. He cannot be on the ground.
Wow.
So they escorted me out, way out into the field where the arena was sitting. And I'm standing out there freezing because all I have is a short sleeve warm-up on my warm-up gear.
And you're outside? Oh, and wow.
They put you outside in the snow. What's the arena sat on? That was the
wow.
So I'm sitting out there and I'm like, I'm freezing. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna freeze. I'm gonna die out here. Because my team is on the floor. Nobody can leave. They have a game to play. So, and they had the police out there watching me like, you know, if you go across this little boundary line here, we got to put you in jail, son. You know the rule. The injunction read, if you step foot on the grounds in which this arena set on, you're going to jail.
And you're standing there in a T-shirt.
I have my warm-up gear, you know.
Your warm-up gear,
not big old warm-up gear like they have today. This is like short sleeve warm-up gear, you know.
Wow.
So snap-on pants, the flippity-flop. So the police said, you know what? We're going to lose our jobs on this one, but get your ass in this car and warm up because you're dying out there. So they put me in the car and they warmed me up and I got my sea legs back. And we talked about where I was from, Mississippi, and what I've been going through. I told them my history, and they were like, boy, we're going to lose our jobs for this one. And so when the game was getting closed down because we had the radio on, the game, they were like, get back out.
Yeah, get back out. Wow.
Don't know me. You don't know us.
They don't know, right. Wow. At least they didn't let you freeze out there, though.
Yeah. Lenny Wilkins and Rod Thorne come running across the crowd to pick me up. Come on, man, let's get out of here. We got to get out of here. We got another game tomorrow.
So you dealt with that on and off for the entire year.
For the whole year. And then we get the cases come before the Supreme Court. And when it got in front of the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall and Justice Douglas are asking the question, why is this young man such a problem for the NBA to let him play? Whereas in tennis, you can come when you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Hockey, you can come when you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball, you can come in when you want to. But only the two revenue sports, basketball and football, you can't come into professional ranks. And then Thurgood Marshall mentioned there's a tinge of racism here. Mm-hmm. And yet you can send a soldier, you can send this young man off to war to go to Vietnam to be killed. And yet he can't make money for himself. Right. And so they kept thumbing through law books and everything. And then he all of a sudden, Justice Douglas said, well, under the Sherman Antitrust Act, and am I right, Justice Marshall? Under the Sherman Antitrust Act, you can't stop a man from making a living in America.
Right.
And that's when I won the case. I had won the case, and I'm like walking out of, woo-wee. I got my case. I got my name on my ruling. I fought for this. This is so beautiful.
Wow.
And then the NBA said, we're not going to name it the Spencer Haywood rule. We're going to call it the hardship rule.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And
then, took me right out of the picture. And
I remember.
Well, let me tell you about the story, though. What happened was, you know, because the Players Association was against me.
Right.
So we get to Milwaukee. We were getting ready to play the Bucks.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
And all the players would usually go down into the locker room and make me stand outside and stuff and like sweat it out. And before the owner would say, all right, go on, play the game. And they went down. And Kareem wouldn't go down. Mm-hmm. He stayed up top with me. I was like, oh, cool. You're going to be tight, boss. Right. So we were like, let's get it on. Shit, we're going to show who the two best players are in the league. Let's get it on.
Right.
So, and he embraced me and the cameras was there. And they were like, oh, man, this must be something good. So that's when everybody in the union said, forget about it. Wood is okay, man. He's cool. He'll be able to play. And so that was Kareem who gave me that lift there.
Wow. Wow.
And then later on when my first born was took place from Iman, my wife at that time, the model.
Supermodel.
I'm coming down the street in New York City, boy, 20 some million people. And I'm walking down the street on Third Avenue, going to my home, like, oh man, my baby just was born. Everything's good. I'm hearing somebody, hey, whoa, whoa. I'm like, who the heck is this? And it's Kareem. Hey, man, come here. Hey, he's riding down on the cab. So I said, get out of the cab. Let's go roll. My baby was just born.
Right.
So we got together, man. We went up to the house and sit down and listen to Coltrane Transition. I remember the song Transition. Yeah. We like listened to that sound and stuff. And it was just talking about the beauty of life and where we are today. And that was my firstborn child, man, in 1978. And I saw him.
That's great.
So he's
great.
There on that one. And
that's
then,
great.
Of course, you know, he saved me when I was.
Before we get to that, we'll get to that though. But, okay. You know, that was so iconic because after he kind of embraced you publicly, then afterwards, you said everyone embraced you because then after that, then Wilt, then Jerry West and Elgin Baylor and Oscar, everybody publicly embraced you. But Kareem really started the whole thing because the NBA was really kind of telling everyone to stay away from you, right? To not embrace you. And I thought that was just amazing. So,
yeah. So, it was going to put me through hell again, the players. And
right.
I played against the Lakers. Wilt said, come on, I'm going to take you out and get you some food. It looked like you're hungry. And I was like, oh, man, Wilt. So I'm sitting with Wilt eating dinner. And Wilt is saying, what gave you the right to sue the NBA for the rights to play? Do you know what I did? I was like, what did you do, Wilt? He said, when I wanted to leave Kansas and come into the NBA, I didn't sue them. I had to go to the Globetrotters for a year and play. I could have sued them. You are crazy to sue them people, man. They're going to have you ostracized for years. Now, what's that mean, ostracized? What is that? And lo and behold, they told me later, the league said, if you're not an all-pro player, which is meaning you're a top five or top 10 player, you ain't going to be on the all-star team.
Is that right? Sure enough,
I never was on the all-star team after that, if I wasn't an all-pro.
Well, yeah. when you went to Seattle, you was an all-star for 4 to 5 years, right?
But I was the first team all-pro, and then second team all-pro.
Okay,
I was after that.
No choice.
Like, no, you ain't gonna be. So
wow.
How do you average 20 and 10 on a career? And no All-Stars after that.
Interesting. So this brings us to that 79-80 season. And yes. You're there, and now here's winning time starts. And I got this. I'm enjoying the show. I am. We just finished the first season. I'm enjoying it. And you don't have an issue with it the way some of the teammates have vocalized their issue with it. They actually did a segment about your hardship Supreme Court case, and they included that history in there. So I didn't figure that you would, but not to put words in your mouth, you don't have an issue with the show the same way some of the other guys
do. No, because, you know, at that time, I didn't know that I had been lugging around PTSD.
Mm.
I was from my childhood and from what had happened to me with the Supreme Court, man, it's brutal
right.
stuff. And I'll give you a little background. Kurt Flood went to the Supreme Court right after me. And mm-hmm. remember, he didn't play any more games in Major League Baseball. He ended up going to a country and staying in that country because he couldn't live in America because people hated him so badly and they treated him so badly. And then when he came back to America, the Major League Baseball players, all of the greats that we know of today, and everybody got endorsements, buying teams and all of that, they treated him like doo-doo. And he just died off, man.
Wow.
So I was always cognizant that I got to stay strong because I'm carrying the banner for him and Muhammad Ali, the two that was at the Supreme Court, either before me or in my period of time. So I'm the only one standing after that for changing the sport.
And reiterating, you know, the show starts with with Magic, and there would have been no Magic if it weren't.
There wouldn't have been no Magic.
They wouldn't have been able to draft him
right there.
Right.
No Jim Jones on that team. No,
right.
All those players would not have been there.
Right.
So it starts with that, and then they bring me in. Jack McKinney was my guy. Bill Sharman was my guy because Bill Sharman had coached against me in the ABA, and he wanted me with the Lakers. So I ended up coming to the Lakers because, you know, Utah had just bought, and the New Orleans Jazz had moved from New Orleans to Utah because I was playing with the New Orleans Jazz with Pistol Pete Maravich.
Right.
Elgin Baylor was my coach. So it was like I had put up some numbers. I got myself really sharp and ready to go ball. I was doing 24-12 when I got to the Lakers.
Right.
And then when I got there, former players, actors and actress, and everybody was around us because it was like Iman and I, we were this hot couple.
Of course.
And so lo and behold, at the Forum Club, they start sliding, you know, coke around, and everybody was doing coke back then. It was like it was like having an apple, you know. And so one night, I got into a person's house, and we were sitting there, and he was talking about how, since you sort of organic, and you've missed the vegetarian and all this stuff here, and you want to keep your body clean, I got a good way you can do coke without even snorting it. So I'm like listening to the lie, but wanting to believe the lie because I was with my celebrity friends and all.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, hit this pipe, man. This shit has been washed out and it's clean and pure. So I hit it and I stayed there with the pipe all up until like about 4 a.m. Then I realized I got practice, man. I got to get out of here.
Oh, wow.
So it caught me my first journey on it. It was like the disease was sitting there because I also look back at my history when I do study of my family. My grandfather, people like that, died of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. To that time, I hadn't lost all four, but four of my brothers and sisters passed from alcoholism and stuff. So the disease was there, just waiting to pop his head out. And when it popped his head out on me, there I was, caught up in it. And so I would like go for days and days and months without it and just be fine. And then some trigger, somebody would, you know, I could never get away from these people from the Forum Club because everybody wanted to be around the Lakers and be a part mm-hmm. of the Lakers. I would be sitting there, man, just talking to Jerry Buss or Kareem or somebody. And then all of a sudden I get home and the shit is in my bag. I'm like, who put this in my bag, man? And then you're like, I'm going to tear this up and throwing it in the sink, man. I'm getting rid of this. Now, nah, I'll take just one.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah. So it was like, what's that thing they used to say? You cannot eat one.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
So it just stirred it by right back up. It come right back on me. And so I'm watching my game going from the 24 and 12 down to like 16 and 7. Mm-hmm. By the end of the season, I was a shell of my player, of a player. And so, disgruntled and everything else. And I was averaging about 7-8 points and maybe 4 rebounds or 5 rebounds.
So let's back up a little bit because it mm-hmm. showed a lot in Winning Time. And I think Wood Harris did a phenomenal job.
Phenomenal job.
Portraying you. Like he's an incredible actor.
Yeah, well, see, Wood and we did speak.
Okay, y'all spoke.
During the shooting, doing okay. that thing, because he wanted to talk to me about, like, what is the character, why, and I wanted him to have the freedom to do it. I was not going to say, hey, you know, don't do this, don't do that. Oh, my God. What about my family? What about my kids? No. Come with it.
Mm.
Be you. This is your time to shine, and this is my time to shine because all of a sudden you're going to reflect back on, you can't take that 1 year. You got to look at all of my years.
Right, right.
And that's what is happening with all of the people. Let me just say one more thing.
Uh-huh.
I'm out in Los Angeles for Kareem's 75th birthday because I'm the only person he asked to fly in. So I'm like, okay. Oh, cool, man. So we had Herbie Hancock. We had all these people. And so I'm like, we're getting ready to go out on the floor to celebrate the 75th anniversary. And LeBron come running up. Oh, man. I'm like, man, no, he put your big old body on me. I can't hold you up like this. Thank you, man. Thank you. You know, I always know your history, so I'm down. And then Westbrook, Russell is like, yeah, Wood, you the man, man. Thank you. And then other players come, hey, man, thanks, brother. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? So then I go out on the floor, and then the Oklahoma City, Lakers are playing Oklahoma City. Those young players coming by, and I'm thinking, why aren't y'all talking to Kareem? It's his birthday. No, man, we've been watching Winning Time, and we want to thank you for what you did for me. And I was like, wow, isn't God great? Wow. Ain't God something, man?
Yeah, man. I think that's great. One of the things that Winning Time has done is really educated a lot of young people on who Spencer Haywood is and what he did. And that's why they're going to Google you now. Like, wait a minute. You know, he did. Because a lot of times they didn't know that all this stuff happened. They didn't know that you had to take the NBA to the Supreme Court and that they tried to keep you out. All that, they didn't know all that part of history.
They didn't know it. They didn't even know what kind of player I was until there was an event that took place in Washington. The Wizards was doing highlights of me, you, and all the players that played there. And they sent me the highlights, and the players that were playing that night, Dallas Mavericks and the Washington Wizards, they played my footage up there. They were like, whoa, this guy could have played in my era. Because they showed some nice footage. I'm blocking on one end, running down the other end, posting up, dunking on people. They were like, huh. So players now watching my footage on YouTube and stuff and watching my podcast, which is the Spencer Haywood Rule podcast.
Yes.
They are like, these guys are learning, and they are like, I think they're getting ready to do the name change on my ruling. Hopefully they will like say the name of this rule is the Spencer Haywood Rule, because the NBA and their powers that be and the owners decided it would never have the name that the U.S. Supreme Court has given it. It's Haywood versus the NBA. So we're not going to ever call it that. They call it, when I came out of the court, it's the hardship rule.
Right.
My name not associated. Next, it was the early entry. My name is not associated with it. The third is the, like, one and done. My name is not associated with it. So you don't, you have CRT, critical race theory where you don't know, you like erase the history.
Yeah.
And then they gave it to Larry Bird. It's the Larry Bird rule now.
I didn't know that.
Larry Bird exceptional rule. And then they have the Oscar Robertson rule, but there's no Spencer Haywood rule. And there's only one rule, is the Spencer Haywood rule.
That's ridiculous. I didn't know that.
It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know. So let me ask you this. So one of the things that it showed on Winning Time, you know, it showed really the dynamic between you and Kareem. It really highlighted it. Y'all had some intense scenes going on. Of course, in the at the end. So let me ask you about two of them. And it was the when all of the play, and you have to tell me because I've read conflicting information about what happened. So when during the playoffs, I think it was like the second or third game into the playoffs.
Third game into the finals
against
76.
Right. So tell me exactly what happened.
What happened was in between the 76ers game and the Seattle game, when we had won the Western Conference Final, I, for some reason, in my mind, I thought I could do one before, you know, do a hit of coke before I, before while we had time in between, before we go into the finals. So I did it, and I got to practice, and one of the people I was getting high with, because these are all famous people, so I can't say their
name. Yeah, don't say their name.
They'll shut down your broadcast.
Yeah, don't say their name. Don't say their name.
So it was like, hey, man, you need, you know, your heart is beating so fast. You need something to slow it down. And I was like, okay, give me a Quaalude. So I took a Quaalude, and it didn't work real fast. So I said, take me a half. I took a half. So I get to practice. I go home. And I clean up and do all my stuff, and I get to practice. I fall asleep at practice.
Okay.
And Cooper's waking me up, and everybody's trying to get.
This was literally on the floor, though. You're on the practice.
No, it's just at a practice on the floor. We was doing stretching. So when you do stretching, you know, you're laying down, you're doing all your.
No, but I mean, you're on the court, though.
Yeah, I'm on the court. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
So yeah, court at practice.
Okay.
And so I fell asleep, and then I was out of it. So I went home and regrouped. Then we started to see, we started that series off with the, against the Philadelphia 76ers. And I was playing in those both games and I was doing all right, but I wasn't myself. And I remember one pass that came in and it was like right in my hand, in my hands. And I couldn't quite hold it, you know, because this coke and all this stuff in your body, it just, it had me up. And so I go into the huddle and start yelling at Magic, man, you putting all that spin on the ball, you trying to mess me up. You know, psychologically, it's like my psyche is going too, you know? So, and then the next time Kareem is on the free throw line, I have a tennis ball in my hand. This is the second game in the final. I have a tennis ball in my hand. That ball falls out of my hand because I'm trying to get my hands back. I'm psychologically out of order, and my hands are trying to get back. And the tennis ball rolled on the court while he's shooting his free throws to win the game. So, and then that's when they had it in for me for a long time.
Right.
And the NBA, the Laker management, and the players decided, well, you know, we're not going. And I was like arguing at that time, please, guys. Like, sit me down on the bench, say that I got a breakdown, something, but don't suspend me from the team. We only got like four games at max to go.
Right.
So let me walk out of here with dignity. I'll get help. I'm going to go to Phoenix. I'll go someplace and get some help. I need help.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. Everybody was like, you know, and the league was like, we finally got him.
So was it?
Years, we got him. We got him now.
On Winning Time, they showed it as though it came down to the players' vote.
Players did vote on me.
They did vote, and then the scene that you had. And I want you to walk me through the actual, you know, not we have the Winning Time scene, and just walk me through what actually happened. The scene with you and Kareem when he came and he broke the news to you, and then told you because
he was the captain, so he had to break the news.
Okay.
And then, you know, I was like, devastated because I had played all my life to get.
But how did he tell you the news, though? How did he tell you the news?
It's just like he did it in the film, you know, like, man, we voted on you and we want you to go. And I was like, wow, man, y'all couldn't let me, y'all couldn't bury me on the bench. Because guys at that time was being buried on the bench. And also players were being, you know, like, he's got a bad ankle right now. He's got a hurt knee. So we got to set him down. He can't travel right now. His knee is bad. You know, it's a lot of ways you could have handled it. But it was some venom going on because the wives and the girlfriends had built up their husbands against me because Iman didn't know how to drive. She was from Africa and she lived in New York. And we don't need to drive in New York. You transfer. So you go out to L.A. She didn't know how to drive. Nobody took time and said, well, hey, let me go pick up his wife and bring him along. The wives, we didn't have no communication. The girlfriends, they were all thinking that she was like showing up on them. Because my friend Vernell De Silva, Dr. Vernell De Silva, was a professor at Long Beach State in Black Art History.
Okay.
And so he couldn't get out of class until a certain time. And when he got out of class, he would go by and pick up Iman and she'd bring her to the game. But yet she looked like she was coming in like 5 minutes late. And she would walk along the sideline and come to our seats. And so the wives, they just hated her for that whole year. Like she's stealing all of the wives' thunders and this and that. So it was a lot of undercurrent shit was going on, man.
Right.
It was so deep. And so when it came time for players to make a choice, they said, hey, you out of here. And you ain't gonna, and on top of that, when I finished, when the shit was over with, they decided you don't get a playoff share.
Oh, wow. I was gonna ask you about that.
No, I didn't get no playoff share. And then on top of that, I was like, well, you know, I played all season, so can I come to the
parade?
You know, the ceremony, the parade? Yeah. Never. You can't, we voted you as a team. You can't come to the parade.
That's what the players said or the management?
Players and management. It was a joint venture.
So then how did that affect you and Kareem's relationship? Like what was the dynamic?
It affected me, but I knew that I was so out of order that I didn't blame him, but I did. I was very angry with him because of the fact that, you know, we have been these revolutionary guys who have been joined together at the hip, so through revolution, through everything, you know. So I was very hurt and angry about it, but I was more angry at myself because I allowed myself to get in this predicament, you know. And I was angry at Kareem because I thought, you know, he should have like pulled me aside and took me in his arms and taken me to the mosque and we could have some salat. I could have prayed. I could have got all of this. I would have been in a different environment, but you know, he was dealing with his own thing and it was just, it was a weird time, man. It was a weird, weird, sick time, but I soon forgot over it because right after that, when we got back to, I had to go to Italy and I came back. And then I came back and I played with Washington, had that big year there. And then my mom was in an automobile accident. So I had to come home to take care of my family because they were from Somalia, my kid, my daughter. So the league never let me back in. But in the meantime, she was bugging me about, you know, you are suffering. So you just can't go to these AA meetings and these NA meetings. You need to go to treatment. So I went to treatment. and learn about my life and learn about recovery and stuff. And then once I got clean, I was like, well, I'm still just as crazy as I was when I was high. So, and then she suggested that I do something differently. And I was seeing a psychiatrist and I went to see the psychiatrist and he was like, man, you're suffering from PTSD. And I was like, my PSA count is good, bro. I'm so dumb. I'm thinking PTSD is like the prostate cancer thing. Like, no, man, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, cool. And I'm trying to play around. So I started getting treatment and I started getting help. And I started pouring out all of that stuff that I had been been buried down. It was a buried down story that I never told people in public because my mom was ashamed of it. My sister was ashamed of it. When my mom was 11 years old, she had to go work into the big house in Mississippi with a farmhouse. The mm-hmm. farmer that owned the house, he raped her.
Wow.
At 11 years old, wow. I have a sister that was half white. She had to live through a whole dichotomy of what that was about. And right. my mom couldn't tell the boys about that in particular because we were hunting season. They would kill us quickly, you know. So that was buried down. So all of my stuff started coming out and I was like, man, this is pretty good. And so for years, I've been receiving mental health. And I also still deal with, from time to time, my AA meetings, my NA meetings. And so my daughter, Shakira, was seeing me doing all this stuff. So when she go all the way to college, first thing she said, I'm going to be a psychiatrist.
Oh, wow. Wow,
so,
wow.
Guess what? So now she's full circle. She's like 31 years old. She's on the board and on the cycle and works for the NBA Players Association.
Oh, wow. As
one of the psychologists.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's
Shakira Haywood. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So let me ask you, I want to ask you about two different things. The scene at the end of season one with you and Kareem, and he came to your house after the parade. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how they showed it in Winning Time. And he came and you was like, you know, you got a lot of nerve coming to my house after you ain't let me come. Did that really happen like that?
Yeah.
And then y'all had this big embrace and, you know, he was, you were saying like, I'm nothing. And he because was like, no, you
he's,
are.
He's just, because he, it was nothing because of like, the scene with John Quinn, the farmer, the white guy that was over the farm for the black folks. He was a black guy, but he was half white. So he was shit on us. You're never going to be nothing. You ain't shit. So that's what that scene go back to.
Oh, wow.
Kareem was saying, no. Shit, you're a champion. You're Olympian. You're a gold medalist. You are all of these things. But we normally would have went through all of that. But since we were dealing with dialogue, he had to just cut it to that dialogue level.
Got you.
And
got
so, you know, I feel so much joy. I have 34 years now of sobriety. I have my friend back. I have Kareem back.
That's great.
Because he's always been my friend. We've always been dog tight.
Right.
You know, you can see some of that in the movie. You know?
Yeah.
And I have a word that I sent out to Kareem. I want him to watch Winning Time because he's a strong hero in there. He's the anchor for us all throughout that movie. I want Magic to see it because I think Magic need to see it. I'm not talking about the sexual stuff, but to see what impact he have had on the game and mm-hmm. had on us as a team. Mm-hmm. But yet, after all of that, he has done so much for the AIDS community and it's a lot of our people are really still struggling. This is the disease is moving around. Mm-hmm. And Magic also did so much with his Starbucks and all. That was a meeting place for people to have 12-step meetings and all of that stuff. So his brother Larry used to work with me, and so did Isaiah's brother when I was doing a program in Detroit where we were going to like clean up Detroit.
Right.
You know, clean all the drugs in Detroit. We're going to make everybody whole. You
wow.
know? So Magic has that offer that he can do. I know he's making a lot of money with the Dodgers and all that, but the human side of him, I would like to see him come back to it. I'd like to see him watch this film and also to meet the guy who's playing him. He's from Muskegon, Michigan.
Right.
He's never talked to Magic, nor did Solomon has talked to Kareem, who's playing Kareem.
Yeah,
I just think that if they talk with those guys, and because the series going into season two,
right,
you would want to have your imprint on that. Mm-hmm. And with Jerry West, I just love to see him. I would love to see him talk with the actor that's playing him. And Jerry West was an intense man.
Okay.
He wanted us to win. He wanted things to be that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. It ain't no crazy thing. I know sometimes the film looked like he's acting crazy and doing, but that's his intensity. He lost to the Celtics 7 times in the finals.
Right.
I mean, you think you would talk to you? Would you have some intensity?
Yeah, no, I'd be very intense.
Exactly. So it's not far-fetched, but not only that, but Rodney, you know, Rodney Burns, who wrote and one of the producers on this film. We have all of these black actors who are finally getting a play and getting jobs.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be careful that we don't squash our own people in the process.
I got you.
Yeah, so I would like to see my guys embrace it, embrace the film, and embrace the people who are working on it, the white actors, the black actors. Everybody should embrace it. And because it's here, and it's, you can't change it.
You know,
it's God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, right. The courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's that step right now. Wow. I would like to see us step, make that step. I made the step.
Right.
I don't have a problem with anything. And I'm praying that Wood Harris win the Oscars for me.
Oh, he did a phenomenal job. I can't even say it enough of how great of a job that he did. And really, you know, Solomon Hughes did a fantastic job with Kareem. Yeah, I mean, all the acting was just superb, you know, to be honest.
And just think, Solomon and Quincy never had an acting.
Met them. Yeah, and Quincy, you think you're looking at magic sometimes.
You're looking at magic.
You know, he really embodied magic.
Yeah, and I'm doing an interview, I'm calling him magic. Oh, Quincy, I'm sorry. Quincy. And with Solomon, I'm looking at him. Now, look, Big Kareem, let me tell you something. No, I mean Solomon, brother.
they morphed into them.
So, yeah.
You know,
so everybody is watching it and has seen it.
Yeah.
I think that it would. You know, it's a chance for us to let it all out, man. Clean it up, clean up our slate, and move on.
You know,
it's good sometimes to you know, like dirty out some of your laundry and just move on.
Well,
you're far greater than that.
I think some of the stuff that you see the progression, even with you speaking here now, and you know, I'm familiar with all the work that you do with mental health. You know, your book, the way that you've been an open book now, talking about the things that you've gone through. In an effort to, you know, to help people who are going through something and suffering in silence, you know, when you're become a mental health advocate. It's just, I just want to tell you that I haven't never had a chance to tell you how amazing it is that you're doing God's work the way that you're doing, because that's what it really is. You know what I mean?
You're really helping God's work.
So many people.
You know, if it left up to me, I'd be on the islands playing golf.
I mean, it's amazing the fact that, and I do want to ask, you know, there's a part in the movie where your whole life would have changed, and you can tell me how, you know, factual everything is, but after they voted to take you off the team, it's like you went into a little bit dark, and you said, okay, I'm going to, you know, you called your friend, and you said, I want to put a hit out on the Lakers, and I want to be, and then you stopped them, but had you had not stopped them, your entire life could have been completely different. We couldn't even be here right now.
Everything would have been, it would have been so much chaos. It would have been so sick. It could have been something really, really, really bad for the league, for the persons, the people that are involved, the families. I mean, to do that. No, that was the intoxication, the drugs, what led me down there, because I was really hurt, man. Because I grew up in Mississippi where, we had a 12-gauge shotgun and a 20-gauge shotgun by our door, because if anybody mess with this family, we're gonna burn down this town, we're going to tear up this place, and we're going to burn up the house, and we all gone. Because that's how we had to live, because of slavery and because of the way we were living. Mm-hmm. And so if you touch one of us, It's all gonna blow up in all everybody's face, because we were living it. We were like, you live or you die, you know. And so I had a flashback to that point, but I never was going to do anything like that. But you know, the movie kind of embellished it a little bit, so I'm good with that.
A little bit,
because it can show that there's redemption, there's God is available for you when you just call on it.
Mm-hmm.
God, I want help. I need help. I need to get out of this nasty place that I am in. So it was a thought, but it wasn't like an action that I went searching and found all these people. But okay. I'm okay with the movie doing that because it's going to help somebody else. It's going to help somebody that's out there. And I've gotten so many calls and so many texts and so many emails, so many hit me up about, man, I never thought I could quit. But I'm quitting now. And we got people, man, dying throughout the throughout America, these Americans, America with, what's that stuff that they have now? They think they're getting some coke, but they end up getting fentanyl and it's killing people. Just died. Three students died up in at Ohio State this week. It's just, so if I am the sacrificial lamb for all of this, I just think God is using me again, just like he used me with the Supreme Court.
Right.
Make a change. And here I am making a change in the recovery community and with the people who need mental help.
Right.
Yeah, because it is mental wealth. You know, it is your mental and it's your wealth. And so Black folks in America, we all suffering from this. We should, my folks have been going to see seeing psychiatrists and getting mental health experts for years. We need to get involved with our health because it's tearing us down. It's driving us to drinking. It's driving us to eating bad food, doing all of these wonderful bad things to ourselves. So I hope this movie did that. And I know the platform I'm on now with my podcast and with you and your podcast, Bill Roden, and all of the great podcasts I've been on this week. We have we've crossed some boundaries. We're helping some people and we're growing. And I'm just grateful that I'm alive and well and healthy and I'm good.
Well, like I said, I can't say enough how much respect I have for you to be able to be an open book. Because like you said, sometimes it's tough to allow an actor, like when you said, when y'all were talking, you said, no, take it there, show everything, show the way I am to be. But it's hard for people to do that because they either want to be embarrassed, you know, people want to keep their stuff to themselves. They don't want to, you know, show stuff to their families, but you being an open book is actually helping other people who are struggling with this. And I can't say that enough. You know, it's, you know, I'm sure you're going to continue talking, continue doing the work that you're doing, continue being an advocate for mental health and everything like that. But the amount of people that you're going to continue to reach is gonna blow your mind. Like, I don't even know if you can even
conceptualize. It's blowing my mind. It's blowing my mind as we talk. I mean, you know, my wife, my current wife, Linda, she was in the healthcare industry with Blue Cross Blue Shield. She was an executive there for 30 years. So, I mean, I got some tools. I got some people around me with some skill.
Right.
And you know, I still have my family. We still have all our issues and everything, but we have a way to get to the resolution. We can talk about it. And that's where the biggest problem with all of us is that we don't get around and talk about it. It's like, I remember years ago, don't you talk about your uncle now, you know.
Yeah.
Don't you say nothing.
Right.
He's just a little sick today.
Right, right, right.
He was drunk.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Well, hey, I know I've kept you probably longer than you imagined, I wanted to tell the whole story.
I'm a fan of yours. You know how we go. I love what you've been doing. I love what you're going to do in the future. You have a strong voice. You've been consistent, and you blocked LeBron James' shot on that tape. I was
looking on that tape of the Wizards.
I was like, oh man, LeBron sat down on his knee and said, oh man, he left me low.
Well, it was an honor to even be included in that tape. When you told me about that, I was like, oh, they included a brother on the tape. That's the highlights. Who is his highlights? That's cool.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But hey, all right. Last thing before we go, tell everybody about your podcast. I know you have you just did an interview with Dr. Solomon Hughes, and you had Quincy on there. You had Rodney Barnes, and I saw a good interview that you had with Derek Anderson talking about mental health. Then you have the first one, which is Who is Spencer Haywood, that you're just really just introducing yourself and giving your own story. Talk about everything that you're going to be doing.
Well, what happens, your podcast. You know, my podcast is on YouTube and it's on all of your podcast platforms. you can go and get it. It's under the Spencer Haywood Rule podcast. And the first one was my introduction of who I am, what I've been through. So that's a journey. And the first coming out of the box I did, my first show was about mental health. And it's with the director for the NBA Players Association mental health program, Dr. Parham, and Derek Anderson, who has a terrific story to tell. We went through all of that. And then my one that I just recently did was with the cast from Winning Time and the director and the writer. So we're going to do the second one with their other actors. So Wood Harris can't do it right now because he's shooting another film. He missed the busy. So I kind of wanted to go into his mind and see what do you think about old Spencer? Because everybody, my kids love his portrayal of me because they've all known about my history and I talked to my family about all of it. So it wasn't a surprise. Mm-hmm. And so I just want people to join me on my podcast because every week I'm going to be putting out something really nice and special. And it's not always about, it's going to be about sports and all of that stuff, but it always come back to mental wellness because I think that that's the cornerstone. We got guys who are like Ben Simmons who need to hear, Kyrie Irving, a number of players need to hear that there's a way out, there's an opportunity for them to move on with their life once you admit to certain things.
Got you. Well, Godspeed to you. Continue doing what you're doing. Love the work you're doing. Love following you. We've been following each other on social media for a long time, so I love seeing all your stuff. You know what I mean? So keep doing your thing. And it was an honor to be able to sit down and interview you. And much respect to you.
Much respect. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Rematch. You can find more episodes on basketballnews.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review. You can also find my articles on basketballnews.com, along with exclusive content from Kenyon Martin, James Posey, and more. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at AtonThomas36. Let me know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see as a guest. I would love your feedback.